Hello, Hilltoppers. My name is Maddie, and you are listening to WGLZ 91.5 FM. We are college radio, and we are passionately vocal. Today, on this installment of our series, Distinctive Discussion, we have a very special guest with us, and I am very excited to have her here on the phone. Her name is Dr. Edith Witter. She is a world-renowned marine biologist with her PhD in neurobiology from UC Santa Barbara, a trailblazer of bioluminescence research and deep-sea exploration, and she is the CEO and founder of the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, or ORCA for short. Dr. Witter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Maddie?
I'm doing fantastic. Now, for our first segment, we will be discussing Dr. Witter's PhD research, which was centered around bioluminescence in marine animals. But before we do that, I think it's important to provide some background information to those that aren't familiar with this topic. Dr. Witter, would you care to explain to our audience what bioluminescence is and why many animals, especially those in the deep ocean, choose to utilize it?
If people are familiar with bioluminescence, it's fireflies, but there's a lot of other animals, mostly in the ocean, that can make light. And they do it by mixing chemicals together in their body, just like when you break a light stick and shake it up, it can make light. That's what's known as chemiluminescence. But those are chemicals made by humans. Bioluminescence is chemicals made by living creatures. And they make it in a bunch of different ways, actually. They don't all use the same chemistry. They use it for a huge variety of things, finding food, attracting mates, defending against predators. It helps them survive in a dark world.
Now, Dr. Witter, I know that your thesis was based around a type of bioluminescent plankton called dinoflagellates. While you were studying this plankton for your PhD, you wrote in detail in your memoir, Below the Edge of Darkness, about how you use special equipment to measure the colors that emitted from these plankton. Can you elaborate on what specifically this equipment did and the process you went through to gather this information?
Yeah, so the piece of equipment I was talking about was an optical multi-channel analyzer, which was a new kind of spectrometer at the time that was very sensitive to dim light and could look at the entire spectrum simultaneously instead of scanning across it. So it was actually ideal for looking at short, dim flashes of bioluminescence. And actually, that wasn't the focus of my thesis, but my major professor was really talented at getting funding, and he got major grant to get one of these new spectrometers. And I've always been kind of a gadget freak, so when it came into the lab, I couldn't keep my hands off it. And I kind of became the lab expert on it, at which point he comes to me and says, well, now that you can make this thing do what we need it to do, I think we need to start sending you to sea to measure all these animals in the ocean that make light that nobody's ever been able to measure before. And suddenly I was this thing I had always dreamed of being, which was a seagoing marine biologist.
That's fascinating. So furthering the conversation about the special equipment, you and a group of others spent a long time working on a camera called the Eye in the Sea, which uses a red light in order to stealthily capture pictures of organisms that a human may not otherwise see. Can you explain why deep sea organisms cannot see the color red and why that fact is important for the function of this camera?
So if you've ever opened your eyes underwater, everything looks blue, and that's because red light is absorbed so quickly underwater that it disappears. But in fact, a few animals down there can see red light, but most can't because it doesn't do them any good. They primarily live in a blue light environment, and so they only see blue light. But there are these remarkable fish called stoplight fish that also have light organs under their eyes that can emit red light, and they can see red light, so they can use it like a sniper scope to be able to sneak up on animals that can't see them but can be seen by the red illumination. And I was actually able to get an emission spectrum from one of these red light emitters and was very surprised to discover that there was a very sharp cutoff filter in front of it. And I thought at the time, you know, it's giving up a lot of energy to do that. It's got to be important. So when I was trying to develop the Eye in the Sea as an unobtrusive way to explore in the deep ocean, I was trying to use red light and having difficulty because the animals still seemed to be able to see it. So I decided to imitate that stoplight fish and got a filter that was very much like what it uses. I had to have it designed for me and used that. And then sure enough, I could see without being seen. And that's what led to some pretty fantastic discoveries using that camera system.
Yeah, I know that. Well, that's kind of my hobby is like I've always been really into deep sea ocean animals. And I remember I did a speech actually about this topic, and I did I talked a little bit about the stoplight loose jaw because it's just fascinating to me how evolutionarily this fish like uses this light to see like small crustaceans, krill, that kind of stuff with the same color, but the fish themselves just can't like perceive it. But it's easy to see that you're quite innovative when it comes to developing new equipment, as you've demonstrated with the eye and the sea, which all these inventions sparked from necessity. So in that same vein, I want to talk to you about how you were able to capture the first footage of the giant squid. Now, you said in one of your TED Talks that you and your team used a fake light-up jellyfish attached to one of your submersible platforms to help lure in the giant squid. Can you describe, like, what you felt in that moment when you saw the squid and what capturing that footage meant for the scientific community?
Well, you can actually see what I felt because I have a TED Talk where I've got video that was shot at the moment of discovery. We were going through video that had been collected from another version of the Eye in the Sea, one called the Medusa, that could float around in the deep ocean instead of sit on the bottom. And it was that we captured the very first video ever of a giant squid in its natural habitat. And you can see me and then my colleagues all screaming our heads off because it was just such a thrill, such an amazing moment. I think we're all explorers, and that's very innate in us. And to be able to see something that nobody's ever seen before is the thrill of a lifetime.
Yeah, I can only imagine just the excitement that was in that room that day. But all right, we're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. When we get back, we will be talking about Dr. Witter's career of ocean conservation and public education through her organization, ORCA, here on WGLZ 91.5. We will be right back. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't think that you're listening to just any radio station. We're college radio.
And we're passionately vocal.
We're WGLZ FM West Liberty. Hello and welcome back to Distinctive Discussions here on WGLZ 91.5. During our last segment, we spoke to Dr. Edith Witter about her experiences as a marine biologist conducting research for her PhD and working on groundbreaking ocean exploration technologies. During the segment, we will be talking about Dr. Witter's work with the Ocean Research and Conservation Association. Now, you started this organization because you wanted to help protect the ocean you love and started ORCA with the goal of developing and using more advanced technology for marine conservation. What were some of the challenges you faced while starting this organization?
The biggest challenge, as with all such endeavors, was funding. I had a business model when I started ORCA where we were going to develop lower cost, more compact, real-time monitoring systems for measuring water quality. I'd spent a lot of my career working with engineers to solve challenges in the deep sea, and I wanted to do something for my own backyard, the Indian River Lagoon, which was deteriorating. And in 2004, there was a report that came out, the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy report, that detailed the deteriorating state of the ocean and called for more real-time monitoring. And usually when that happens, it's followed by funding, but in this case, that didn't happen. And then 2008 came along, and the bottom fell out of everything. And so I didn't have any financial support for ORCA, and it came very close to folding, but I got a MacArthur fellowship and put all of that money into the completion of the water quality monitors and getting other ways of monitoring pollution. So we have grown and actually have three locations now locally, and just about to move into our new headquarters.
Now, that's actually what I want to talk about with this next question. I know that some of the work that Orca does is to lessen the effects of pollution on marine ecosystems through your ecotoxicity program. And you mentioned the Indian River Lagoon, which is one of the main focuses of this program. Can you explain why sediments harbor these toxins and what processes Orca has come up with to decrease the level of them?
So our tagline for Orca is mapping pollution, finding solutions, because really the best thing you can do for protecting the waters is to keep the pollution out of it in the first place. You can't take the cream out of the coffee. And so we're always trying to locate the sources of pollution and get them stopped before they enter the lagoon. So we do that with the water quality monitors that we've developed, the Kilroys. But we also have this mapping technique that we've developed where we take sediment samples from the bottom and we test for various pollutants. But it's so hard to know, you know, what do you test for? Because you could spend a fortune testing for everything. So at the very beginning, I was looking for some kind of broad-spectrum bioassay that I could use to indicate where things were more toxic than other places. And I settled on, not surprisingly, bioluminescent bacteria. It was an assay called Microtox. We didn't develop it. It already existed, but we adapted it to sediment testing and use it to create pollution maps that look like weather maps where red is high toxicity and blue is low toxicity. And they proved very powerful for being able to locate sources of pollution.
So one of the missions of Orca is to make ocean conservation and scientific data more accessible to the public and to policymakers. And as someone who wants to one day produce educational content for television, I really resonate with your organization's goal of making knowledge about marine conservation more widespread and digestible. That being said, is there anything that you wish the media and television industry would like to talk about more in regards to conservation and marine biology? And what is your opinion on television programs like Discovery Shark Week or BBC's Blue Planet in regards to contributing to the public's understanding of marine organisms?
Yeah, it isn't just marine organisms. I really wish we were doing a better job overall in with our media, with our news organizations, and with our schools of teaching science as a way of knowing. It's just so critical right now, and science is the most important tool we have to explain our world and our place in it. And it's so important that we effectively communicate science because it's critical to solving the world's most urgent issues right now. So, you know, there's an example given of, you know, what if we taught baseball the way we teach science? Then you wouldn't actually get to play baseball. You just learn the rules of baseball. And it wouldn't actually be until you got to graduate school that you got to reenact certain famous baseball plays. What kind of baseball players would we have? And science is something you do. You don't just read the facts about it. You have to have practiced doing it and learning how it's done. And it's so critical to so many of the decisions that people need to be making now. I just would like to see science as a way of knowing be much more of a focus in presenting information about science to the public. You know, how did the science get done? How do these choices get made about, you know, which drugs will work for a particular disease and which types of anti-pollution agents will actually function effectively and how can we be testing for things?
Lastly, what can the public do to aid Orca in their restoration efforts?
Well, I mean, it's sad to say, but we're always in need of funding. That's our biggest need. But if people want to go to our website, which is www.teamorca.org, there's a lot of information on there about pollution that we've been finding, which I think transfers to other locations around the country. For example, one of the things that's proven surprising to me is just how impactful grass clippings have been on pollution, especially here in Florida, where we've got so much landscaping where we've got sloping grass lawns right down to the edge of a seawall, and then every time the lawn gets mowed, the grass ends up in the canals and forms this black mayonnaise on the bottom of the estuary that is this muck that smothers the life out of everything. And, you know, just learning how to manage the flow of water and runoff from the land is just so critical, and that it's things people can be doing in their own backyards. Even if you're not right on the water, you've got runoff that's going into gutters that probably feed into major water bodies somewhere. And the more you can know about what's getting in there and what you can do to stop it, the better off everybody will be.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Witter, for speaking with me today. It was a pleasure getting to talk to you about your organization's conservation efforts and about your research, and I wish you luck in all your future endeavors. For those of you who are listening, thank you for tuning in. My name is Maddie, and I am passionately vocal. Let's get back to the music here on WGLZ 91.5.